The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with a story about traveling solo. A woman alone in Oman, 3 weeks along the Arabian coast. It's written by Noah Avishag Schnall, a photojournalist based in Paris. Her article appeared in the New York Times ongoing series, The World Through a Lens, this in the May 9, 2022 issue. As the subhead notes, in December 2021, a photographer set off on a 2,600-mile road trip, traveling from the Yemeni border to the Strait of Hormuz. Here's what she saw. Now, before we begin her article, let's have a brief explanation about this series, which is also included with the article. And the editors write, at the onset of the coronavirus pandemic with travel restrictions in place worldwide, we launched a new series, The World Through a Lens, in which photojournalists help transport you virtually to some of the planet's most compelling places. This week, Noah Avishag Schnall shares a collection of images from the coast of Oman. So there you have the background. Now let us begin. I could barely tell where the salt ended and the sky began. I was on my way to Misra, Oman's largest island, when the surrounding terrain turned into a massive salt flat. At its edge near the road, two Bangladeshi workers were up to their ankles in the mixture of liquid and minerals, pushing the salt flakes into pyramid-shaped piles. I, too, waded in, the horizon blurred by an orange-pink haze. Finally, I reached the ferry, and after more than an hour at sea, arrived at Misra. I began driving down the west coast of the bowtie-shaped island, hoping to make it to the southern point by sundown, a distance of some 40 miles. The farther I got from the port, the fewer people I saw, until, pulling onto the sand of Bourassa's beach, there was no one. With the trunk of my SUV open to the sea, emitting only light for miles, I could hear the small shore creatures scuttling near the water's edge. Alone, skirting the boundaries between sand and sea, I'd reached the midpoint of my trek. This past December, 3 months after the Sultanate of Oman lifted its COVID-19 travel restrictions, I flew from my home in Paris to the southern city of Salalah, intending to explore the entirety of Oman's coastline from the south to north. For the next 3 weeks, I would be traveling solo across the edge of the Arabian Peninsula, clocking more than 2,600 miles, improvising campsites, off-roading with middling success, and loading my rental car onto ferries to reach remote islands, then passing military checkpoints, and finally reaching the northern tip of Oman and the waters of the Strait of Hormuz, one of the most geopolitically contentious and carefully monitored waterways in the world. When you conjure images of the Arabian Peninsula, whose inhabitants go by the pan-Arab term Khaliji, the Sultanate of Oman is perhaps not the first country that comes to mind. Saudi Arabia's presence in the world stage has been dominant in recent years. Both the United Arab Emirates and Qatar have made political and cultural impressions internationally, and the entire world has watched in horror at the ongoing civil war in Yemen. And yet Oman has nurtured its reputation as a neutral and often tranquil place, even serving during the Obama administration as a conduit for nuclear talks between the United States and Iran. The country has made few ripples on the international front since the British-backed coup in the 1970s, when a reformist son deposed his father to become the new sultan. The leader, Sultan Qaboos bin Said of Oman, who died in 2020, subsequently transformed Oman, catalyzing mass modernization while maintaining the absolute monarchy. For me, the relative calm was one of its most attractive features, that and its unique climate. Because of its location, Oman is one of the rare countries in the Arab world that experiences a Kharif or monsoon season, which turns the landscape a lush green. Floods mountains with waterfalls, fills the wadis or valleys or riverbeds with fresh water, and brings a thick fog to rest on the southern governance of the country. Oman doesn't really have an off-season. The Kharif is popular with the Khalijis, and during winter months, the Sultanate receives more European and Indian tourists. As I'd missed the Kharif, it was the ideal time for beach-bound adventure. In my dedication to traveling the entirety of the Omani coastline, I'd be foregoing inland Oman, famed for the Rub al-Khali, or the Empty Quarter, considering the world's largest continuous sand desert, and made up of approximately 250,000 square miles of uninterrupted sand dunes spanning across Oman, Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. And in a stubborn commitment to driving the entire coastline, I drove some 3 hours west of Salalah to the border of Yemen to officially begin the trip. The route to the border was treacherous, full of repeating switchbacks as the road ascended into the Dafar Mountains, and the quality of the roadway significantly deteriorated the closer I got to Yemen. The border crossing near the town of Safiyeet wasn't very imposing. A makeshift hut of corrugated iron paneling, covered in camouflage netting and yellowed by the sun, with a sand-colored SUV in its shade. Disappointingly, there was no signage. This was the closest I'd been to Yemen since December 2013, not long before the civil war began. After conferring with his colleagues in the hut, the guard allowed me to complete a U-turn in the no-man's land between Oman and Yemen, and with that, my journey had officially begun. The first thing I did on my expedition was to pull up for a warm cup of sweet milk tea called Karak, an Omani favorite made with spices, at the nearest place I could find. It was significantly colder and windier here in the mountains. By nightfall, I'd reached Faseya Beach, some 65 miles from the border. Wild camping is legal in Oman. One has the right to pitch a tent on any public land. Before picking up my car rental, I requested that the rear rows be removed, which would give me the option of sleeping in back. That night, I kept the trunk open, tucked into my sleeping bag, listening to the waves. In the morning, cows walked the beach while I swam. Later, I waited as they blocked the mountain road until I could pull back into Highway 47. My trip progressed in undulating chapters. Periods of isolation and contemplation were followed by moments of extreme focus on precarious situations, which then swung into generous cultural exchanges. At Mugsail Beach, with Mount Kamar looming in the distance, the shallow pools of light green and blue water gathered in pockets in the sand, as dromedaries or one-humped Arabian camels walked along the shore, silhouetted by an orange sun, ropes of a vine called goat's foot crisscrossed the beach with their pink flowers dotting the sand. Just as the sun was fading into a fuzzy haze, a traditionally dressed couple walked barefoot along the shoreline. The man in a dishdasha, an ankle-length collarless tunic, and kuma, a rounded embroidered hat, and the woman in a abaya, a long black cloak and hijab. At the Korori archaeological site, I met a man who looked to be in his mid-40s. We struck up a conversation. When he found out that I have Yemeni ancestry, he warmed to me. I sat with him through a few of his cigarettes. He was fascinated by my Jewish heritage, saying I was the first Jew he had ever met and asking to take a photograph together. Then, as though he needed proof of my Jewishness, he asked that I write out several names in Hebrew, which I did. We exchanged numbers and planned to meet that evening for dinner. After visiting Wadi Derbat, famous for its plateau of waterfalls, I drove to Mirbat, where my new friend had dropped a pin on my phone to share the exact location. He had ordered takeout, and we took the bags to the beach, where he laid out on a mat, and we sat eating cross-legged, using our right hands in place of utensils, in the traditional manner. Having finished our meal of chicken biryani, we stepped out onto the rocks, where the ocean lapped onto the stones. We went as far as we could without getting wet, finding a place to lean back comfortably. And then, as if old friends, we had a long talk about a range of topics, including religion, while staring up at the sky. The next day, I stopped to have coffee in the bustling village of Sadah. As soon as I sat down, the neighborhood children playing at a nearby table were intrigued, likely with my unruly and uncovered hair, Western, though modest, clothes and vaguely familiar features. The girls waved at me, while the boys made faces and lyled jokes, clearly having a cheeky laugh at my expense. These exchanges are among my favorite moments on the road. No common language, no inherent gain for either party, just a bit of wonder on all sides, full of hand signals and carefree laughter. A man in Western clothes and his young daughter joined our interaction. He introduced himself as a native of Sadah and suggested a restaurant with the best view in town. Requesting that I refer to him as Ali, he later said he was a member of an elite military unit in Oman. Ali proposed a drive to Native Falls, where, as one local described, the water comes from the mountains like tears. I bathed in the fresh water, which felt noticeably distinct from mornings spent in the brine. Drying off, I recalled the conversation we had shared earlier in the day. "I'm crazy, you're crazy," he said, as both of us laughed. What Ali had meant, restricted by the limits of our common language skills, was that I was a woman traveling by herself, an idea that to him posed a rather intriguing cultural question. He called it absolutely mad and yet also brave. He was liking it to his métier, a high-altitude military parachuting, which he knew was both courageous and a bit unhinged. I'd seen videos of his jumps, she writes in parentheses. In other words, this was Ali paying me a compliment. A couple of days later, I was off-roading in the sugar dunes of the Al-Khalaf in an attempt to reach Bar al-Hikman before sunrise. Suddenly, my SUV ceased moving forward. The wheels rotated in place, sending sand in all directions. The car sank into the white lumps. I tried in vain to dig myself out, but it was futile. I hesitated before calling Ali. Within 30 minutes of dropping him a pen, two friends from Ali's unit pulled up, barefoot, wearing dishtashes and masars, embroidered headscarves, in a beat-up 90s truck the color of sand. 10 minutes later, employing the practiced skill of people who had clearly done this many times before, they yanked my much larger vehicle out of its pit and drove it to the blacktop. They offered me a place to stay at their camp for the night, but I had taken up enough of their time. We said our goodbyes, and my hands pressed together in supplication, uttering profuse shukrans, or thank yous. They sent me on my way. Feeling inordinately lucky, I found an easily accessible beach nearby, splayed out in the trunk, and passed out. The following morning, I walked across the stunning white sand beach, sat in the water feeling grateful for it all, and looked back at the dunes that had nearly devoured me the night before. The farther north I traveled, the craggier the terrain became, stonier, less smooth. An hour north from the port city of Sur, I was enchanted by the many smaller coves that broke up the long stretch of beach near Bemba Sinkhole. Weaving among them, I admired the massive chunks of braying coral and the way the morning sun reflected pastel highlights onto the shores. Exactly 2 weeks into my trip, with only brief interludes from the intermittently unforgiving coastal terrain, I pulled into a parking spot on a perfectly manicured street, lined with elegant palm trees in a swanky corner of Muscat, Oman's capital, and walked my weary self into an international coffee chain. Hoping to visit the Sultan Qaboos Grand Mosque, I missed the window for non-Muslim visitors. Instead, I walked through the surrounding gardens. Evening had fallen by the time I departed Muscat for Sheenas, a coastal town near the border with the United Arab Emirates. I counted the gas flares that dotted the coastline as I continued my drive. The following morning, I found a small, unassuming cafe for breakfast. The corner shop, open on two sides, let in much appreciated breeze. I joined a morning crowd of South Asian workers silently drinking their kais, and munching their chupetas, transfixed by the overhead TV, a few flies resting on the plastic tables we all shared. I saw one of the men dip his chupeti in his tea, and I did the same, not half bad. After their meal, men would approach the sink in the middle of the shop and wash their hands and mouth, then use the thin, waxy paper provided by the shop to dry themselves off. I followed suit. These types of shops can be found all over the Sultanate, a staple of communities in a country where foreign workers, mostly from Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan, make up a significant portion of the population. In Oman and many of its neighbors, the pandemic led to a reckoning about the many inequalities that exist in the Gulf states, which rely heavily on migrant labor. I was finally ready to head to Mosandam, the northernmost of Oman's 11 governorates, which borders the Strait of Hormuz and is separated from the rest of the country by a spit of Emirati land. Mosandam has beautifully barren fjords, hugging green-blue bays, jagged mountain ranges, and inlets that reveal small villages accessible only by boat. The port city of Kasab is a 4-hour ferry ride from Sheenis, north along the edge of the Arabian Peninsula and around the Cape into the Strait of Hormuz. I drove off the ferry into town and let curiosity lead me along the Kasab coastal road, gradually nearing my ultimate destination. The Mosandam mountainscapes were intimidating, dwarfing the few homes that were built right up against them. One road appeared to turn into the mountains, and I decided to see where it led. After about 5 minutes, the paved road gave way to dirt. I got out of the car to take some photos when I heard a man's voice call and echo to me from across the valley. Looking in the direction of the sound, I discerned a figure waving me over. It turned out to be a group of young Omani men who went on to invite me to join their breakfast, revealing a spread of coffee, karak, tandoor bread, baked in an underground clay oven, honey, and cheese. The home, land, and surrounding flock of goats belonged to a family member, and they were all visiting from their respective homes in the nearby Emirates. That afternoon, I made my way to the northernmost point of Oman, or as far as I could go without risking further off-road hijinks, and gazed out over the coast. The waters were deceptively serene. I found a place to rest among the rocks and contemplated the historic nature of the sea passage. Only 21 miles wide at its narrowest point, the Strait of Hormuz has been essential for trade between civilizations for thousands of years. Recently, some 20% of the global oil supply has flowed through the strait, which is the only way for oil tankers and cargo ships to reach the Indian Ocean for maritime trade. Tensions at this choke point have led and continue to lead to numerous conflicts. Taking in the sea view from a small park just southwest of the Horn, I waved to a group of women walking in the sand. They waved back. I longed for interactions with Omani women, but had experienced very few throughout the journey, partly a result of my limited language skills and the solitary nature of my trip, and partly because of the complicated gender dynamics in a country with a spectrum of conservativeness. I'd spoken briefly with a young doctor on the ferry to Misra. On the deck, reserved for families, the other side was reserved for single men, where we were both trying to get a good picture of the sunset and joked at our unsuccessful attempts. The conversation trailed off, and she returned to sit with her two friends. At a generic food stand in Kasab, a group of young girls approached me, admiring my camera. I let them hold it and play, which drew the attention of some teenage girls who wanted to practice their English. "You're cute," they said to me, giggling. Reflecting back on these fleeting moments, I was thankful to have had them. I left Mosandam the following morning and headed back to mainland Oman, where I booked a hotel in Muscat and, for the first night in weeks, slept in a bed. When I awoke, the city had flooded, limiting the options for my final day. I lay back down on the bed. I could still smell the smoke emanating from burned frankincense resins, could feel the air from the Jabal Saman on my skin, and could hear the batting of green sea turtle flippers on the sand. Wow. What an impressive story, huh? By the way, Noah Avishag Schnall, a visual journalist, is based in Paris, and she has an Instagram account if you want to check her out and learn some more about her international travels. Well, next we're going to travel back to the United States of America, more specifically the West Coast, where writer Sheila Yasmin Merikar reveals how Los Angeles has changed in a good way. As the subhead states, the city has a lot more to offer than the obvious, with new genre-bending restaurants and bars and happenings galore. Its comeback story is well underway. Ms. Merikar's article, published in the May 19, 2022 issue of the New York Times. Sun, sand, and sightings of celebrities in their natural habitats. Tourists have long descended on Los Angeles for some combination of the above. If you're keen on that cocktail, rest assured it remains an offer. Rest your way into a coastal hotspot like Nobu Malibu or Giorgio Baldi, and you can indulge with abandon. But Los Angeles has more to offer than the obvious. New genre-bending restaurants and bars have cemented the city's status as a culinary capital of the world. Stages outdoors and in booked with acts, big and rising. And museums, including the long-delayed $484 million homage to Hollywood, the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures are courting crowds, travelers coming in droves. Los Angeles' comeback story is well underway, said Adam Burke, the president and chief executive officer of the city's tourism board, adding that Los Angeles is projected to see more than 46 million visitors this year, close to 2019's record high of 50.7 million tourists. We're optimistic that we'll see full recovery in Los Angeles by the end of 2023, Mr. Burke said. While California lifted almost all COVID mask regulations in February, Los Angeles officials still require masks on public transit and transportation hubs, including airports, buses, and rideshares. On a late April morning, about half the travelers at Los Angeles International Airport appeared to be wearing masks. It's not really being enforced, a check-in agent said. Restaurants and bars. If Los Angeles wasn't the nation's preeminent city for sushi before, it is now. Sushi Tama, Morihiro, and Kenkan are some of the high-end slingers of omakase. Chef-curated tasting menus that opened during the pandemic and won fans over with takeout boxes of fish that shimmer like jewels. Now you can book seats at their respective sushi bars, but plan in advance. Seats at Kenkan's counter, where dine-in meals range from $125 to $250 per person, can be particularly hard to come by. The Black Lives Matter movement brought renewed attention to Los Angeles's black-owned businesses, especially restaurants. Critics are raving over Biberi, an Ethiopian-inspired vegan restaurant that opened in Santa Monica in 2021. Most dishes are under $20, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a more beautiful latte than the one served at Bloom & Plume, a coffee shop and cafe that the celebrity florist Maurice Harris opened next to his East Side flower shop just before the pandemic. Espresso drinks start at $3.50. Several websites offer guides to the best black-owned restaurants in the city. Thrillist is particularly robust. Low-carb cliches be damned. Pizza is having a moment. Pie after pie flies out of the open kitchen of Mother Wolf, Hollywood's busiest new restaurant. And I should say buzziest new restaurant. Fans include Rihanna and Michelle Obama, which occupies a gilded Art Deco landmark, the Citizens News Building. Overheard at the bar, if you squint, it's almost like you're in New York. Downtown, De La Nona serves grandma-style pie, starting at $16 and up, and crisp Negronis. In Echo Park on the city's east side, Gras makes an argument for pizza as health food with its organic sourdough base, seasonal ferments, kimchi, pickled cucumber salads, and natural wine, which incidentally has inspired so many new bars, you could be forgiven for thinking someone had stumbled onto an underground supply. In Silver Lake, Melody, which opened in 2017 and was revamped during the pandemic, Voodoo Van and La Pharmacie de Vin, all within 1 mile of each other. The neighborhood caters to cocktail connoisseurs, too, with Bolita, a Cuban-inspired cocktail bar that opened in February, and De Buena Planta, a Tulum-inspired patio opened in March that specializes in tequila and mezcal. Non-drinkers know that no ABV, alcohol by volume, elixirs abound all over the city. Bolita, for instance, serves several spritzes, $8 and up, that won't leave you with a hangover. Then we have museums and live events. Los Angeles major museums are open again. Starting May 21st, the Broad will showcase a new collection of works from Takashi Murakami, as well as a series of art around the theme of American flag. Many of the city's museums, including the Broad, the Getty, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, which opened in September, and features six floors of movie industry memorabilia, require advanced reservations, and have their own masking and vaccination protocols. It's best to check their websites before visiting. There is no shortage of events uniting aficionados of various stripes. The Hollywood Bowl and the Greek Theater, Los Angeles' prime outdoor performance venues, have returned with a full slate of concerts. Foodies will break bread on May 21st and May 22nd. Now get the name of this place, Eats Gone L.A., and that is five E's, Eat, with an S in C-O-N. Eatscon L.A. Yes, it's really how it's spelled. A May Food Festival hosted by the restaurant review website Infatuation. Tickets go from $10 and up. Baseball fans can convene at Dodger Stadium for the Major League Baseball All-Star Game on July 19th. That's just south of Los Angeles. Jazz enthusiasts come together for the Newport Jazz Festival in June. Then we have Rockers Rejoice. Pasadena's This Ain't No Picnic brings together dozens of rock bands in August, including The Strokes and LCD Sound System. Sports fans take note. With the addition of Angel City Football Club and the National Women's Soccer League, Los Angeles now has 11 professional sports teams, the most of any city in the country. NFL fans have been flocking to Inglewood's newly opened Sophie Stadium, where would-be quarterbacks can take a guided tour and test their skills on the field, where the Los Angeles Rams won the Super Bowl in February. In the same complex as Sophie Stadium, the new YouTube Theater features a robust lineup of Latinx artists this summer and fall, including Rosalia, Gloria Trevi, and Sebastian Yatra. For decades, Los Angeles Pride Festival and Parade has been one of the largest LGBTQ pride events in the world, and it'll be back in full force on the weekend of June 11th. Old attractions have been updated. The Warner Brothers Studio Tour has reopened with a state-of-the-art Welcome Center. And Universal Studios Hollywood has added Secret Life of Pets ride. Then we have high-design hotels. Los Angeles added 2,100 new hotel rooms in 2021. And there's some home away from home for every type of traveler. Downtown, the Kelly Wurstler designed a proper hotel, 1100 South Broadway, with rooms starting at $349. It has become a destination for locals and out-of-towners alike, with its Art Deco meets modern-day Globetrotter aesthetic. Pendry West Hollywood at 8430 Sunset Boulevard, room starting at $525, brings a dose of maximalism to the Sunset Strip with sumptuous rooms designed by Martin Brudinski, a rooftop restaurant and helmed by Wolfgang Puck, and a happening pool scene, just to add to it. Then they had the Mayburn Beverly Hills at 225 North Cannon Drive. Those rooms start at $1,095. So lots to do, see, and have fun with in Los Angeles. And that, my friends, is going to bring us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, you can call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.